then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising.
Greetings from Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's March the 31st, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my voice for freedom, tis the rising.
No Edgar Steele news this week. I just checked the Free Edgar Steele website before I started recording, and there's no update on whether or not the defense expert has been granted access yet to the original audio recordings, which have been squirreled away by the FBI in a vault in Quantico, Virginia. So we may have to wait for the trial itself to find out. That trial is still scheduled for April the 26th in Boise, Idaho. Now, I want to start with one quick comment. A few of you have dropped me hints about your concern that I may be overreacting and getting a little quote-unquote paranoid about cognitive dissonance agents operating against the movement on the internet and against the Northwest Front in particular, messing with my Facebook account, cyber-stalking me all over the internet, and popping up on any board where I post with the same scripted horseshit, except under different names, so forth and so on. Now, for those of you who came in late, cognitive dissonance is the name of a program put together by a Jewish White House deputy communications director named Cass Sunstein, or that's what he was back when this program was exposed in the media. Where he may be and what he's doing right now, I'm not sure. Sunstein is one of the funny little men behind the curtain who actually run things in the corridors of power. And I suspect that after all the negative publicity he got last year, he's faded behind the curtain again. But if there's any doubt about what I'm saying here, then a little bit of Googling will clear it up. These articles talking about the cognitive dissonance program run out of the White House are still out there. Anyone can find them, and this deliberate disruption of the right-wing and racial internet does, in fact, exist. It happens. I'm not making this up. Now, the purpose of cognitive dissonance is to use paid operatives of the White House and also government subcontracting NGOs like the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League to act as internet trolls, infiltrating dissident websites of all kinds all across the World Wide Web. Not just white racial sites, but also 9/11 truth sites, birther sites, discussion groups, anti-immigration amnesty sites, Tea Party and anti-Obamacare sites, so forth and so on. Basically, any website that is discussing things the regime does not want discussed. They are targeted for disruption and harassment. All of this, of course, is in complete contradiction to the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, but who gives a damn about that anymore? The regime obviously doesn't. They're doing this not just for the purpose of gathering information on the regime's political opponents, but also disrupting and spreading disinformation, demoralization, doubt, and confusion through the use of false identities. Now, these are Sunstein's words, not mine. This stuff has been exposed in the mainstream media time and again down through the past couple of years, ever since Obama was immaculated back in 2009. I have to admit that as many bad things as Jug Ears and his little Jewish friends did when they were in power, so far I haven't seen any evidence that the Bush government ever went as far as the Democrats have in this. Now, that's one of the differences between the two. Conservatives tend to simply ignore their critics and do whatever the hell they want, no matter what anyone says. They don't try to silence their opponents because, for better or worse, they honestly don't give a damn. Liberals, on the other hand, can't stand being criticized. They can't abide any hint that they might be wrong about something, and they try actively to silence their critics by force when they can get away with it. A few months ago, it was revealed in the media that the FBI and several other government agencies had commissioned some techie think tank, whose name escapes my senile memory at the moment, to create what they referred to as persona management software, whereby one internet operative could get onto Facebook and create up to 16 false identities, each with a phony IP address, in order to deliberately manipulate public opinion on certain issues like Obamacare, legalizing illegal aliens so they can vote Democrat and create a one-party state, so forth and so on. Now, this week, we have another revelation of this nature. A registered nonprofit charity called Media Matters, apparently fairly well respected as such thingies go, now turns out to be nothing but a front for the mysterious Jewish international multi-billionaire George Soros. Nonprofits are not supposed to be engaging in partisan political activity at all, but needless to say, the rules don't apply to Democrats or liberals, and they damn sure don't apply to George Soros. This week, Media Matters got hit with a media leak of its own, and it turns out that they've prepared a secret plan to, as they put it, wage war on Rupert Murdoch's Fox News, with a view towards discrediting the network and shutting it down and making sure that only the left-wing liberal viewpoint prevails in America's news media, as was the case for so many years. Not that the neocon viewpoint of Fox is any improvement, mind you, but you have to bear in mind that until we actually start doing something that causes the wealthy people who run the world some kind of inconvenience, we're not the real enemy. They're wealthy rivals like Fox are. Anyway, this plan is funded to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, presumably provided by George Soros. And the strategy includes all kinds of spying and monitoring and hacking into Fox's computers to steal and leak emails, massive troll attacks on Fox News blogs to try and make out like no one supports them and the whole world is liberal, which is untrue to the point of being ludicrous, malicious harassment lawsuits, deliberate pranks and punking to produce embarrassing sound bites on Fox News personalities, and attempts to undermine Fox's paid commercial sponsors and hit the network's cash flow. This is what they tried to do to Glenn Beck about a year ago, without success. Sounds like war to me. Infiltration of blogs with comments from fake internet IDs? Hacking and denial of service attacks? Malicious and baseless lawsuits? Trying to cut off someone's income? Any of this sound familiar? Now, as to this allegation about me being paranoid about cognitive dissonance ops cyber-stalking myself and other Northwest nationalists around the net, and harassing and sliming anybody who makes a favorable reference to myself or my novels of the Northwest, well, let's think about this. Granted, I'm nowhere near as big as Fox News, but since we now know beyond any doubt that the organized Jewish liberal left and the United States government are acting in tandem to carry out activity like this, is it really such a stretch to at least consider the possibility that I and the Northwest Front might be at least a minor target of this kind of thing? I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Just because you're paranoid, that don't mean they ain't out to get you. Paranoids have enemies, too. Moving right along here, last week I played an audio clip from an old album entitled Nazi Rockwell, which contained excerpts from a number of interviews and speeches that Commander Rockwell delivered back in the 1960s. I mentioned once before on this podcast, in March of last year, I think it was, that I was appalled to learn that so many people in our movement these days who claim to be white nationalists and who even claim to be national socialists of a sort seem to have no idea who on earth George Lincoln Rockwell was. Now, the simple fact is that the people in the white resistance movement these days, such as it is, are like most Americans in that we have only the most vague conception of our own past, and only the most vague conception that we even have a past at all. We do, a long and honorable one. You know, our movement wasn't always comprised of... Well, it wasn't always comprised of the kind of people we get today, put it that way. Now, last week I was nattering on Facebook with a young man in England, and I was equally appalled to discover that, as intelligent and as squared away on Britain's present racial problems as he is, he seems to have no idea on earth who Sir Oswald Mosley was. Now, that freaked me out. Back in the 1930s, Sir Oswald Mosley was the head of the British Union of Fascists, also known as the Black Shirts, and had fate been kinder, he would have been Prime Minister of Great Britain instead of that disgraceful alcoholic moral vacuum called Winston Churchill. To try and describe Oswald Mosley's life and career is, frankly, way beyond the scope of anything I can do or say on this show, although I will say something now that I've never mentioned before. Sir Oswald Mosley died in 1980 at the age of 84, but he kept involved in politics right up until the end of his life, running a small group called the National Party of Europe. And in 1979, which would have been about a year before his death, I was informed by a mutual acquaintance in the UK that Sir Oswald had read a couple of pamphlets I'd written and published through Liberty Bell Publications called The Nature of Liberalism and the Structure of Government in the National Socialist State, and that he had made some favorable comments on them of a general nature. I have no details, but I believe it's true, and I will always consider it one of my crowning achievements to have met with the approval of one of the last of the truly great men the white race has produced. I'm going to play a selection of Sir Oswald Mosley's speeches for you now. Please bear in mind that these are recordings from the 1930s in two cases, and in the third case from 1954. So the technical and sound quality here may render these recordings a bit hard to understand. I have a pretty good guy who does the sound editing on this podcast, and hopefully he can come up with some way of making these tracks a little bit more clear and understandable. Now, the first cut will be from a phonograph record that Sir Oswald made to his fascist black shirts in the 1930s. Mosley was banned from the BBC, which in those days meant he was banned from the airwaves completely. And so he used to make dictaphone records on wax cylinders that would then be pressed into several hundred phonograph records, which would then be sent to the fascist units all over the country and played for the membership. Kind of like right-wingers today use cassette tapes and podcasts. The second cut is another speech explaining what the BUF is all about. And the third cut is from an election speech he made in 1954.
Brother Black Shirts, my comrades in the struggle. Our fight is for the soul of Britain. And in that battle we go forward together till victory be won. Our struggle is hard, because we're fighting for something great, and great things are not lightly or easily gained. We're fighting for nothing less than a revolution in the spirit of our people. We must be worthy of our mission, for black shirts are those who are summoned to lead the people to a new and a higher civilization. The black shirt is a revolutionary dedicated to the service of our country, who must always possess the character of the true revolutionary. It is not the character that you observe in the little men of the old parties, blown hither and thither by every gust of fancied opinion, elated by a little success, downcast by a little failure, gossiping and chattering about the prospects of the next 5 minutes, jostling for place, but not so forward in service, without loyalty, endurance, or staying power. Such a character is the hallmark of financial democratic policy. It is the opposite of the National Socialist. In the true revolutionary, the first quality is the power to endure. Constancy, loyalty to cause and comrades, manhood and stability of nature. These are the qualities of the true Briton and the true revolutionary. In our movement, that great character of the British has been reborn. And for that reason, we carry within us the destiny of Britain. We care not whether we win tomorrow morning or at the end of a lifetime of labor and of struggle. For to us, the little calculations of the little men mean nothing. All we care is that when we will, because Britain demands it, and no power on earth can hold down the will within us. Struggles we have had and will have. Blows we have taken and will again. Victories we have had and will have again. Yes, greater victories than even Britons have ever known. Through good and ill we march on, till victory be won, for this is the character of the true revolutionary. In the great moments of supreme struggle and decision, it is easy to hold that character, even in supreme sacrifice. It is not so easy in the hard daily task. It is then, even more than in the great fights we have together, that I would like to be the companion of every one of you. I would like to be with every action team that carries the message of our new faith, the new street. I would like to be with every man or woman doing the hard but vital job of giving leadership to the people in the block of houses for which they are responsible. For these are the jobs that count. By the dedication of thousands to that mission of leading the people in their own homes and streets, revolution is won. In that task, I cannot embody me with every one of you every day. But in spirit, I am with you always. Because this work of the dedicated black shirt will win the Britain for which my whole spirit is given. Together in Britain, we have lit a flame that the ages shall not extinguish. Guard that sacred flame, my brother black shirts, until it illumines Britain and lights again the spark of mankind.
British Union is the movement of the people of Britain. It is their answer and their challenge to the tyranny that today oppresses them. That tyranny is the money power of international finance, which commands government, parliament, and the old political parties. In the service of finance, an obsolete and decadent system is preserved, both in government and industry. Government is paralyzed by a system of universal talk in which nothing can be done, in order that real power may rest elsewhere, not in the hands of those chosen by the people, but in the hands of those chosen by finance. Industry is tied to the international system of 100 years ago, again in the interests of finance alone. In both home and foreign markets, British workers have to compete against the cheap coolie labor of the East, paid a third of our wages and working for 10 hours a day. Yet this cheap slave labor has been supplied by finance with the best modern machinery in order that a higher rate of usury may be drawn from sweating the East than from equipping the West. In face of these new conditions, how can any international system, whether it be capitalist or socialist, maintain the British standard of life, let alone increase it to the high level that modern science makes possible and that our great people deserve? For in this modern age, science gives to us British the power to use our own great heritage of British Empire to build the greatest civilization the world has ever seen. We have the finest workers and technicians. Within the empire alone, we possess unlimited raw materials to satisfy every demand of industry. One thing alone we lack, a market to absorb the great wealth that modern industry can produce. That market is the purchasing power of the British people. They are robbed of the power to buy British goods because their wages are dragged down by cheap slave competition from abroad. They are subject to that competition because finance draws its usury from foreign investment in the shape of cheap foreign goods. We British are denied our heritage by the power of usury. So we challenge finance and the parties who have sold the people to usury to carry out the people's will and to subordinate to the nation the vested interests who today exploit the people. We ask from the people power for the people's government. That power will be freely given by the vote of the people and can be removed by the vote of the people. But the government elected by the people must have power to act. If the people's government has not power to govern, then the money power will continue to govern. That money power has divided the British people in order that it may rule them. We have been divided by the war of party, of class, and of faction. So the British, who for 1,000 years have never been conquered by the foe without, have been subdued by the foe within. Britons, who should be brothers, have fought each other, and alien finance has conquered. Therefore, to our brother Britons, we say, unite. Britain united is invincible and irresistible, and together we will build the mightiest civilization mankind has known. A new world awaits the united will of Britain reborn. Britain's advance in British Union.
A great new field for sweatshops to be opened up so that these new industries which we're creating in Britain today will be destroyed as the old industries were. Simplified, rationalized machinery with a few white surveyors and then the masses of cheap colored labor torn off the land and taken into the sweatshops to work and labor and cough their guts out with tuberculosis until they too are thrown on the scrap heap of the sweatshops. Is that worthy of Britain? Is that to be the future of Europe? And is this competition to be organized within our European Brotherhood, bringing in these sweat fields in Africa into our Europe civilization so that the financial power in one European country can use it against the financial power in another? All the great financial central power of the world, now shifted from the city of London to Wall Street, New York, shall be able, on the mass of money, of wealth, and of power which it brings to it, again and again to exert its influence in politics, until, as you see today, it is childish nonsense to say that a British government rules Britain. It's nothing to do with British government or the British people. The government of the world is the financial government, the power of money and of money alone.
Speaking of things British, after I played the Welsh National Anthem last week, I got an email from a guy who's very much into the Picts, who were an ancient people who inhabited Highland Scotland from pre-Roman times up until around the 9th century AD, when they more or less interbred with the Gaelic-speaking Irish invaders of the lowland areas, to the point where the two peoples fused and became the haggis-chomping, bagpipe-blowing, tartan-wearing Scots we know today. And yes, I know that's a gross oversimplification, but what do you want? This isn't Open University. Not much is known about the Picts, and I noticed that in the movie Centurion, the movie makers have the so-called Picts in their flick, speaking Gaelic, either Irish or Scots Highland Gaelic, I can't tell the difference, which wasn't completely accurate, since most scholars believe that the Picts spoke a dialect of Brythonic, the ancient British Celtic language of the first people to settle the Big Island in the way primordial Iron Age passed. And if the movie producers wanted to be more accurate, they should have had the so-called Pictish character speaking Welsh, which is the last Brythonic language still spoken by anybody. Anyway, I was able to find a song about the Picts. This is Steve McDonald with The Painted Men.
With spear and sword in their hands, from far away land made the whole meeting. The Scotties did battle them so, they were a terrible foe, knowing no fear. I close my eyes to Caithness, Shetland, and into the west for many a year. Naked in battle they go, in wind and in rain and in snow, they knew no fear. Their pain and their fun, second to none, the painted men. We'll be right back.
Last week, I concluded the Radio Free Northwest podcast with a challenge to all my listeners, other than the SBLC spies, the FBI agents, and the cognitive dissonance ops, that is, and that challenge was for you to let me know exactly what it would take, what you wanted to hear from me, to get you here, to the Northwest homeland. I got about 15 or 16 responses, which, frankly, is not as many as I'd hoped for, because I wasn't just being rhetorical. This is a problem that I have to solve. I have to find the magic words, the magic beans, to somehow make all this happen. I have to find some way to get through to you guys and get you to take this Northwest thing seriously, and I need your feedback for that purpose. We'll start with one lengthy email that I received from Michael in Maryland. Now, Michael and his wife have emailed me several times, and they both seem to be intelligent and worthwhile individuals, and I'd like to apologize to them both for not being able to devote to them the individual attention which they deserve. And so I'll answer his email on migration here on the show. I should mention that I've somewhat rearranged the paragraphs in this letter, and I've done some editing so as to remove any personal information which might lead to Michael and his wife being identified and victimized. Dear Mr. Covington, my wife and I have been listening to your podcast since October 2010, after we discovered a reference to Northwest Front on a racialist blog. However, your March 27th podcast was most interesting to us. We wish to rise to your challenge. Some further background. I've been a racial activist since my awakening in the mid-1980s, brought about after my experience with the diverse dormitory living conditions forced upon me while in the Air Force. Oh yeah, that's a very common way to turn average white guys racist. Nothing like being forced to live with niggers and Mexicans to make you despise them. Anyway, getting back to Michael's email. When I was in the military, and this is going back to 1985, I took my 30 days leave and set out for Idaho. I spent a couple of days visiting Pastor Butler's Aryan Nations Church. It was a kind of personal pilgrimage for me. I also went as far north as Sandpoint, and therein discovered what appeared to be the Leave It to Beaverville of my youth. I understand that much has changed since that time. When I got out of the military, I came back to my ancestral home in Maryland and joined the National Alliance in 1995. My wife is 36 and has borne 5 children. Better still, she's on board for another 2 or 3. Her awakening occurred during our courtship. Unlike many white males who wear their racialism on their sleeves, I learned through many failures to lead a secret double life. Oh boy, don't we all remember that part of our lives in political development. I often remark that now I know how faggots must feel, putting on a normal face to the world while harboring a deep, dark secret. I'm sorry to keep interrupting, but that's a very apt comparison, and I myself don't object to using the term closeted to describe most white nationalists, because let's face it, that's what most of us are. And sometimes staying in the closet can be a matter of life and death. Never believe that I don't get that. Okay, back to Michael. When we met, I appeared as just a normal, mild-mannered, concerned, Rush Limbaugh conservative. Then once the hook was set, so to speak, I began to educate her on racial realities. Granted, this process of conversion would not have worked on my wife unless she'd been socially conservative to begin with. I think that many white males fail to get the girl because they begin relationships with women who are already too far gone into the liberal zone, i.e. they watch, agree, and believe every utterance that emanates from the dark soul of Oprah, they adore Ellen DeGeneres, and have convinced themselves that they're really not racist and would prove it if only that nice, clean, affirmative action Negro with the white diction at the office with a middle-class income would ask them out on a date. One day I'll write a how-to book so our men don't have to settle for gook females in order to find traditional women as potential mates. If you'll forgive yet another injection, Michael, no matter how your homecoming works out, I think that book you mentioned would be a very worthwhile project indeed, and I hope you'll proceed with it. Okay, back to the email. Currently, we reside behind enemy lines near the brown town of Baltimore, Chocolate City, Maryland. We live in one of the whitest counties in the state, but if Baltimore started to burn, we would find ourselves in the debris field of rampaging coons and beaners. Getting my wife to acknowledge that Maryland is lost was instrumental in opening her mind to the possibility of migration. I'm able to act because my company, name redacted, is offering a generous severance to those who will voluntarily leave, which should give us 6 months' living expenses before I need to tap into the pension fund I cashed out of, which will provide a nest egg. We've done as you mentioned in one of your podcasts. We went back to the first installment of Radio Free Northwest and listened every night to one previous edition. So, your oratory, arguments, and facts convinced us of the soundness of the plan. The only thing that I can surmise that might persuade others to make the move is recounting migration success stories during upcoming podcasts. What's the old adage? Nothing sells like success. I can understand if the names have to be changed to protect the innocent, but I believe that hearing about other individuals and families' successful migrations and how they overcame their fears and landed in a settlement area would do wonders to calm the concerns of those who are on the fence. Yes, I agree, Michael, and that's another thing I invite you guys, again, who live in the homeland, to email me about. Tell us your own story of homecoming, although you really need to do it yourselves with your own MP3 audio files. It's not much good my reading your success story out on this program. People need to hear it from you personally so that they know I'm not exaggerating and I'm not making it up and you really do exist. Okay, returning to Michael's email yet again. Now, getting to your question, what will it take to bring me and my family there to the homeland? Our greatest fear, the one that made us hesitate, is economic failure and all the what-ifs that go along with that. What if we pick a depressed area to land in and I can't find a job immediately? What if we can't find an affordable house to rent, affordable being between $800 and $1,100 a month? What if we, out of unfamiliarity, land in the most diverse neighborhood in Boise, Moscow, Pullman, Twin Falls, Lewiston, Clarkson, just some of the places we've Googled as we have no idea where to go without some NF direction? We're ready to come, but since you asked, this is what it would take to help make it a successful migration there to a homeland. What we need from you or the NF activists is simply this, direction and information. Our time frame is this summer, 2011. We are not acting out of desperation, but as an overt and conscientious act of racial family survival. Direction. In which settlement area would we have the best chance of landing a job? I'm 50 years old and currently work in a call center customer service job. I have a 4-year degree in paralegal and pre-law, but I became so disgusted with the legal system that I abandoned that career path. What settlement areas have the best schools, white neighborhoods for our 5 kids, 4 girls ages 13 to 5 and 1 boy age 3? What settlement area has the best climate? My wife is afraid she'll be shoveling snow from Labor Day through Memorial Day, and she'd like 4 distinct seasons. Information. What are the best internet sources for locating housing rentals? What are the best internet sources for conducting job searches? Is Monster.com relevant in Idaho, Eastern Oregon, or Washington? Or are there local services that have better listings? What is the best time frame during the summer to come? Sadly, we're going to do this cold turkey without your recommended scouting trip. Okay, frankly, Michael, I really don't recommend that. Once you make the choice, at least you yourself need to come out here and check it out first so that you can actually see where you're headed. Know that you made the right choice and do a lot of the preliminary stuff, like meeting your local contacts, if any, renting storage space, getting a local mailing address at a UPS store, or at least a post office box so you'll have somewhere to forward your mail to. You need to put in some job applications and get registered for various things you need to register for, like the local job center, so forth and so on. Now guys, you need to make a scouting trip, preferably sometime between May and October. Take my word for it, you'll be glad you did. Okay, this email of Michael's is running long, and I still have a lot to say about it, so let's take a second music break, and then I'll get back to some of the issues that Michael's brought up. I guess it's time now for some more racial rock music. A comrade sent this track in for the show. It's called Broadsword. This is Jethro Tull. Okay, getting back to Michael's email and some of the specific issues it raises. First, the question about climate. I get that a lot. The areas you've referred to so far where you're considering settling are all in Idaho, which, practically speaking, includes Spokane. And so if you're wondering about the climate there, basically you get long, cold winters and short, hot summers with fairly pleasant springs and autumns. In the summer, you'll probably want a couple of window air conditioning units in your house, but only for a couple of months, and then you can pack them away until the next summer. And the humidity isn't anywhere near as bad as it is on the East Coast. In most of Idaho, you and your wife will have to do a lot of snow shoveling, yes, although it won't be from Labor Day to Memorial Day, don't worry. The winters in the inland Northwest, including Montana, can indeed be very long and cold, with occasional sub-zero temperatures and occasional blizzards, six-foot snow drifts, and so forth, depending on how high up you are, and a lot of black ice on the roads, which can make driving dangerous, but no more so, really, than Wisconsin or Minnesota or New England. In some parts of the eastern homeland, it's high desert, such as Boise, and you do get a significant winter wind chill factor, but you also get your four seasons there. I was in Boise last May, and it reminded me of Southern California, back when Southern California was a nice place to live, put it that way. Imagine Sacramento or Bakersfield without all the murderous heat and the murderous Mexicans, if that means anything to you. Look, what can I tell you? This is a northern climate, and you're going to need to bring warm clothing. And if you settle east of the Cascades, you're going to need chains and snow tires, and you're going to have to winterize your car every November. That's just the way it is. And that's the kind of climate that our people evolved in back in most of Europe. People live and work and thrive and are quite happy in Idaho and Montana, and you can be too. However, if constant heavy snow is something you want to avoid, you do have an option. You can move west of the Cascades, along the I-5 corridor, or along the coast. Now, the myth about this part of our homeland is that it always rains all the time, but that's not true. I lived for 3 years on the coast in Astoria, and yeah, we did get a lot of rain there. It was about like Ireland, which I didn't mind at all myself. British people coming here will find it very homey, like they do in Vancouver. It is true that here in the Puget area, it gets cold and wet and gray for about 5 months, and we get a lot of rain then. That's from, say, November to March, with maybe one or two snowstorms a year, but usually not major ones. We're not on the actual seacoast, and we have the Olympic Mountains to shield us from the worst of the weather coming from the sea. Portland is even more inland, and it gets less rain and more sunshine, and their summers are usually warmer than Seattle. We're going into spring here now, which is usually pretty nice, but unfortunately brief. Then we usually go into what I call green winter, a time when the grass and the leaves on all the trees are green, and when the sun shines, you'd swear you were looking at a summer landscape, except that it's about 60 degrees out. Now me, I like that. I'm not sure I could ever live again in some place like Texas or Charleston where you turn on your air conditioning in April and you turn it off again around Thanksgiving, and you have to more or less live in it unless you want to suffer heat prostration. I spent a summer in San Antonio once I'd rather forget. It's true that there's also a fair amount of cloud here in the Puget Sound during April, May, and June, but when the sun is out, you can't beat it. Let me say something here that I said in one of my novels. In this western part of the homeland where I live, at any rate, anytime the sun is out and the sky is clear, this place is a paradise, and it doesn't matter what the season is. No joke. There is a saying here that every Northwest winter is the same, while every Northwest summer is different, and that's pretty much true. In the summer of 2009, for example, we had a long spell of almost 2 months where it was so hot I would have sworn I was back in North Carolina, and I really could have used an air conditioner, but I got through it just like I do every summer. Cherry blossom time in Olympia in the spring is as good as Washington, D.C., and I will match the fall color on the trees here against anything New England or the Appalachian Trail has to offer, except that there's less of it because we have a lot more evergreens here, especially Douglas firs, which is kind of the homeland's signature tree. Okay, enough babbling about the weather. Let's move on to your other questions, primarily about employment prospects. Is the Obama Depression hitting hard here? Yes, like it is everywhere else. Is this probably not the best time, in theory, to be upping stakes and leaping into the unknown? Arguably, no, it isn't. A lot of people are telling me that they're hunkering down and clinging to what they have like drowning rats clinging to a piece of wood in a flood, waiting for better times when migration might be easier to do, or so they say, in order to keep on the mailing list and keep the entertainment coming. The question is, of course, will the times ever get better? And if so, Will they get better where you are now? Now, for many years in my past, I didn't really subscribe to this right-wing idea that someday the balloon was going to go up. Now, I still have my doubts, but I'm not so sure anymore. Now, Michael mentions that he has children, five of them, and I know many of those listening to me have children as well. In addition, some of you are middle-aged, and you need to start thinking about your future, so let's do some serious thinking about this. Now, I want you to sit down and imagine, project if you will, what the place you're living in now will be like in 20 years' time. How old will you be? How old will your children be? What do you think the economy will be like? What do you think the educational system will be like if you have children or grandchildren? Will homeschooling be allowed, for example? It's already banned in most of Europe, and I believe in Canada as well, although I'm not sure about that last. Will you have a job where you are now? Will your children have jobs if they stay? If so, what kind of jobs? Will your children be able to go to college and get any kind of decent education or preparation for the future? What will your present neighborhood be like if you stay where you are? Now, it may be fine now, but what about in 20 years' time? What will the general political situation in the country be like? What's with all those niggers and Mexicans all around you? Are they just going to go away or keep on breeding and eating up the available goods and services which are already shrinking? In 20 years' time, how big will the pie be? And how hard will you and your family have to fight for a piece of it? Now, I don't want to go off into a long rant about what's been happening in America over the past few years. You guys know that as well as I do, but I can tell you this much, just in my own area, ever since Obama was immaculated, the local authorities have cut out about half of the local bus routes, and the park where I used to take my health walks has been closed, at least during the winter, and my diabetic testing strips have doubled in cost. Little things like that. And this is a fairly economically steady area because it has a lot of defense contracting and military money coming in through Boeing and the Navy, and of course we got Microsoft here. I'm sure it's a lot worse everywhere else in the country. In fact, I know it is, because you guys out there tell me about it in great detail. Now, the point I'm trying to make is you need to stop worrying about all the short-term risks of migrating, and I don't deny that these exist. And you need to think about the long-term future and what it will be like if you stay where you are. And, of course, all this takes the basic white American viewpoint that it's all about you and your immediate family. I won't even get into the moral or spiritual or character aspects of the migration because I've done that enough in previous podcasts. Just from a purely practical, self-centered point of view, honestly now, what do you think America will be like 20 years from now, specifically in the place where you live now? My guess is you're going to have to move somewhere eventually or be killed and eaten by your neighbors. Why not do it now and come home to the land where God and destiny has appointed we will make our final decision as a race on whether or not we have the right to exist? In a general way, I can tell you what things will be like 20 years from now, where you are. Incomparably worse. Because the basic problems of race and rampant capitalism combined with a social welfare state catering only to non-white parasites will not go away and will only become more acute. Okay, the economy may eventually stabilize somewhat, as it has done in the past, but always at a lower and lower level, like a pendulum slowly losing its momentum and then finally stopping dead. Forget about all the ideological stuff about Obama and the Democrats and legal immigration, so forth and so on. Just look at those little indicators I mentioned, like closed parks and fewer bus routes and more expensive medical supplies. I saw a couple of really interesting items on Drudge Report today. First off, did you know that 13% of all American homes are now vacant? I factor out the niggers and beaners from that. And you are still left with millions of white people who are now homeless or renting or moved in with relatives. Now think of that in terms of human impact on our people, their minds, and their spirits. And think about this. When is it going to be your turn? When will you and your family draw the short straw? Now the second interesting little item I saw on Drudge today was one about how food shortages are finally starting to hit the United States, but Big Chomp, as I suppose you could call the food industry, is concealing the fact by putting smaller portions of everything in their packaging while, of course, keeping the prices the same. They're actually raising the prices and hoping you don't notice that you're actually paying more for less now. Gas is now $4 a gallon in most places, and like always, Americans are grumbling and then paying. But how long can this go on? Especially if Libyan and Iranian oil is cut off through that stupid nigger's spectacular blundering. I say again, think about what your life will be like where you are in 20 years' time if nothing changes. You have a chance now to begin that process of change and take control of it by coming here to the homeland and organizing our own people into small communities in our own land. But that opportunity may not be there too much longer if you continue to tremble and vacillate like a nervous Nelly and wait until you lose your job and your house and you're living under a bridge in Cincinnati or Georgia or Arizona or wherever. I know I'm wandering off topic again, Michael, but I feel pretty strongly about this, as I think you've guessed. Okay, Michael, employment versus locality. Now, from the way you describe your situation, you have a problem, or should I say an issue, that will face a lot of prospective migrants, and that is that if you will continue to work in your present field, i.e. a cubicle dweller, you're going to need a big city because that's where those jobs are. Now, that may not be completely the case. For example, Google was supposedly at one point going to set up in the Dalles, Oregon, basically to glom onto a predominantly white workforce. I don't know whatever happened to that idea. I haven't heard anything about it recently. But basically, cubicle jobs means Seattle, Portland, Eugene, Olympia, Spokane, Boise, and to a lesser extent, maybe Coeur d'Alene, Pullman, Centralia, Bend, Corvallis, places like that. Small town Northwest is probably out unless you're a professional like a doctor or a CPA, somebody who can set up their own practice or business, or unless you can do something with your hands. Now, you didn't say this in your email, Michael, but can you, in fact, do something with your hands? Plumbing, electrical work, carpentry, so forth and so on? The construction boom was still going on here for quite a while, even after the collapse hit, although it's in recession now. And in any case, due to the weather, construction in the Northwest does tend to be seasonal. But still, if you or your wife do have any manual skills at all, anything that allow you to go into business for yourself and provide goods and services that small-town Americans need or want, then the small towns are an option. And if not, with all those kids to take care of, the cities are probably your best bet. Seattle and Portland themselves have a lot of the same race and drug and crime problems that other American cities have. Those three always go together. Although not nearly as bad. There are still livable white areas in both those cities. Now, with a family, you might want to try Olympia or Salem or Boise because those are state capitals, and there's always tax money floating around a state capital and bureaucrats with taxpayer money to spend on goods and services. Internet sources. Start with the official state employment departments in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Montana. Those sites can give you general information and a lot of good links. Now, my personal experience with them has never been good. But then I also have a traceable racial past as baggage. One of the guys who came here on his scouting trip in January, Mike from Pennsylvania, checked out the local employment office while he was here, and he said they were great people, very helpful. And he mentioned this on his audio message a few weeks ago, which some of you may have heard. But guys, it's time we talked about the elephant in the room regarding employment that we all know is there, and we always try to talk around, and that is the knowledge that we need to face up to, which is that unless you are highly, highly skilled and you have a resume out the wazoo for something that's in critical demand, anyone's chances of getting a job anywhere, sight unseen and from thousands of miles away and without even having to come here for an interview is pretty damn slim. Only the very highest echelon executive and government and academic positions are filled in that way. And even then, they're going to want to fly you in first class for an interview first, probably more than one. The way one gets jobs is one is physically present on the ground so one can jump right into whatever opportunity presents itself, even something like a help wanted sign in a window. I'm sorry, guys, but there is really very little that can be done to remove that element of risk. It's always going to be there. The pioneers 150 years ago piled all their possessions into Conestoga wagons and walked across the plains that you'll be crossing in motor vehicles on interstate highways with nice motel beds to sleep in instead of having to roll up in a blanket around a campfire night after night and mount guard against marauding Indians and animals. But even so, the risk of being a pioneer can never be completely eliminated. They took that risk, and you're going to have to take it too. I don't think that any of you will end up eating each other like the Donner Party, but beyond that, there's no guarantees. As to the time frame in summer where you want to come, I myself arrived in late May, and it was wonderful. I first lived in Centralia, Washington, and it was one of the most beautiful green winters I've ever seen here. I wrote an open letter about it, which I may dig up and read here sometime. But that's a good time to travel. All the mountain passes are open, and when you arrive, you'll have about 5 months to settle in and enjoy your new home before your first northwest winter sets in. House rentals. Since I myself have no family and I've always lived in assorted hovels, in Texarkana I actually lived in a crack house, but we won't get into that. You're kind of asking the wrong guy, Michael, but I know in my immediate area you can get something livable for your family in the neighborhood of $1,100 to $1,200. Considering the number of children you have, someone with one or two kids can get something significantly cheaper. I've already sent you a list of local contacts in other areas, and they'll be more up-to-date on their localities, but like everything else about migration, it can be done. You won't be able to get a palace for that price, but you'll be able to get a roof over your head. Yes, it can be done. People are moving here all the time, what we call organic migrants, white people fleeing from the rest of the country and especially from California. It's not like I'm asking our people to embark on an expedition to the moon, you know. Okay, third music break. Since we seem to be doing Celtic fusion type stuff this week, here's a Jacobite song from Belfast rock and roll star Van Morrison and the Chieftains.
Spirit and with mind aflame, so wish him strength and length of days.
Look, people, we have to face up to some unpalatable truth here, because our time is up. reality is about to give the white race a bang on the snoot. For the past three generations, a wide assortment of racist and national socialist organizations, groups, movements, and political parties have striven to achieve some kind of political and social power. Many of these organizations and the individuals involved with such organizations, myself included, have spoken and written about revolution, about creating or taking advantage of some sort of revolutionary situation which might provide an opportunity for us to seize power. Others have concentrated on electoral politics, fielding candidates in local and national elections in the hope of gaining some political influence and power. In Europe, a few such parties have even managed to gain a few paltry offices, always at the cost of sacrificing everything that made them racial and nationalist. And they've managed to bring about exactly zero change in the situation there. Elections aren't the key to power. They are the key to powerlessness and impotence because elected officials don't really have any power anymore. If elections could actually bring about change, we wouldn't be allowed to have them. Always the dream, the vision, the hope has been of becoming or taking over as the government of our entire country and bringing back an idealized American past. Always the dream, the vision, the hope has been of creating a whites-only society where we can restore pride in our race, pride in our culture, pride in our heritage. And yet the hard reality is that in all this time we have achieved nothing. Nowhere has any openly racial movement or group come anywhere near to gaining widespread popular support. Many of these little parties, even in Europe, have barely managed to stay in existence from election to election. In most of our nations, our own people are simply not interested in our message. And when some movement or political party does manage to achieve some success, then one of three things always happens. The movement or party falls victim to the problems created by our own character or lack of it. The movement or party gradually compromises all the basic fundamental principles that makes it truly nationalist and revolutionary in the hope of gaining more support and in the hope of appearing less extreme. Or else the movement or party is banned by the local Zionist government, its leaders are discredited or arrested and imprisoned on bogus charges, and the supporters and members mostly calmly accept this and give up altogether. The result is that white people will become a minority in all of our nations in less than 100 years' time, and soon after that they'll simply disappear and leave the black and brown savages cavorting in the ruins. The black and brown savages will then, in turn, be conquered and either exterminated or enslaved once more by the Asians, who will be the ultimate beneficiaries of the disappearance of the white man from the earth. As I have tried to explain repeatedly, the option of seizing back the entire United States of America from sea to shining sea and somehow causing at least 100 million shitskins to vanish in a puff of smoke simply isn't practical, and it isn't going to happen. There will be no return to Beaver Cleaverville. The last man who had even a faint chance to pull something like that off was Commander George Lincoln Rockwell, and he was murdered in 1967 to prevent him from doing it. The only hope of the white race to survive is thus to found, to create, a homeland for our people. To start from the very beginning, as our ancestors did, to create a new nation. Since there is no part of the earth left which remains unpopulated other than Antarctica, that means that we're going to have to seize some portion of the earth's surface for our homeland in the teeth of determined opposition. And so there is simply no way that we can ever eliminate the requirement that we undergo hardship, danger, suffering, and war in order to ensure that our race still exists a century from now. Now, for reasons that I've gone into before, reasons which have to do both with practical and with moral and spiritual considerations, that homeland must be here in the Pacific Northwest. What we mean to do is entirely possible. We have two great and immeasurable advantages. We possess two things that our pioneer ancestors lacked. These are a conscious and rational understanding of what we aim to do, and a conscious and rational understanding of our identity, our values, of those things which make us who we are, which distinguish us as Aryans, and which give us our culture and identity. That is, we have a conscious destiny and a rational way of life, a set of values, of ideals to follow and uphold. The Northwest American Republic isn't just going to kind of happen like most other countries in the world. Our new homeland will be deliberately made. That is, of course, if I can persuade you to make it. Now, the first step is and must always be for you to come home, here to the homeland, and we start from there. Nothing can happen until we finally begin to build our own communities and the kind of infrastructure and support system necessary. There is a way, the Northwest. It will work if we'll just do it. How many more times must I say this? How often and in how many ways must I reword this to try and get through to you? Now, I know I rant and rave on here every week until I'm sure that to some of you I sound like a broken record. But it's all I can do with what I have to work with. So every week, I desperately try to convey to all of you some sense of urgency about this. I see the death of the white race in what is coming over the next century, for real. And I'm stricken, stunned, enraged, sickened, and terrified. I feel utterly helpless to prevent some horrible unseen cataclysm and a nightmare. I'm utterly helpless to prevent it, or so it would appear. Now, you may have heard the expression rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, and that seems to be all we're capable of doing to stop it. There will be none of us left. None at all. How can you live with that? How can you live with the fact that you're doing nothing? How can anyone simply lie back and accept what's happened to this country, to our whole people, and do nothing? I may have my faults, God knows, but not once in my entire life have I ever accepted the extinction of my race as inevitable. And it is not inevitable. There is still time for you to change who and what you are. There is still time for you to accept your duty and to do it. You start with the simple physical act of bringing yourself and all you have to this new land, where you will not only build your own life, but you will become part of history and the cosmic will of destiny. Our ancestors have done it before, time and again, when they sailed from Europe in those ridiculous tiny wooden ships, when they built a whole new world carved out of the wilderness, when they walked across the plains until they finally reached the shores of the Pacific. We are still the same men and women that they were. The late Bob Miles once said, "A racist is someone who knows who he is." It's time that we remembered who we are. Come home, people. Come home to the Northwest and help me once again build a new world for us all. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom. Freedom.